Sam, keeping it true, watching old movies so you don't have to. With the benefit of hindsight, we'll see where the movies truly awful, or did it change history? Good evening and welcome to the Benefit of Hindsight podcast, the movie podcast in which a father and son talk about movies that they watched together long ago.
We give each movie a memory score and then rewatch the movie to see whether or not the movie is better or worse than we remember. And then we score the movie again.
With me, as ever, is my son Sam. Good evening, Sam.
Good evening, Dad. How are you doing?
I'm all good, which is the answer I give every week, which is translated as what is happening in my life. Other than that, I'm all good. You?
Good, yeah. I've been better. To put it in movie terms, I'm Anakin Skywalker after he had a fight with Obi-Wan.
Oh. Is that in the third one?
It is, yeah.
So you're essentially just lying on a bed of burning sand, screaming...
Pretty much, yeah.
I hate you, with bloodshot red eyes and no limbs.
That's the one, yeah.
Wow, okay. Well, I'm glad you're feeling well. It could be worse.
Could it?
Well, yeah, because at least he's like mildly heroic at that point. It could be the bit where he suddenly becomes Darth Vader and shouts no at the top of his voice in the worst
yeah,
no
that's a good point.
Of
yeah.
all movies ever.
Yeah, we'll see by the end of the podcast if I'm screaming no.
That is very true, yeah. Well, apart from all of the grimness of Anakin Skywalker's downfall, you must have a more uplifting anecdote, or at least some anecdote of the week.
I don't know if it technically classifies as anecdote, but I did discover this and it was interesting. My phone has informed me quite politely, and as of this moment in time, which we're recording, I am 4 days away from being 10,000 days old.
Wow. So you are 9,996 days old.
And 4 hours, apparently, yeah.
And 4 hours. Is it? It is fascinating. I'm very, very interested. Is it like a 4-day warning?
Oh, it could be, yeah.
Because it strikes me as odd that your phone says, oh, you're just 4 days away from, as opposed to announcing on the day, did you know that you're 10,000 days old today?
Yeah.
Still pretty...
Well, I could give the honest answer, but that one's cooler.
Okay. You don't look a day over 9,995.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
But that is one of those interesting things where I will know in 4 days' time exactly where I was 10,000 days ago.
That's a good point. Yeah, me too, actually.
Well, you
not
won't...
Not breathing. No,
you won't have much of a memory of it.
No. Yeah.
Well, there's a whole load of anecdotes we could go down here, but let's not and say we did. 10,000. That means I'm... Must be getting close to 20,000.
Yeah, true.
Wow.
Didn't think about that.
Thanks, man. Sorry. Okay. And on that fascinating 10,000-day-old bombshell, let's move to the emails. We had a lovely email from a nice man called Steve, who is in Newark, which my geography tells me is just outside Nottingham, I think, in the United of Kingdoms. And Steve has been... Also, he says, an avid listener to our podcast and can't believe it's been a whole year since we first landed. And Steve asks a very interesting question, actually. He asks, what has been our favourite podcast episode to record?
Just in terms of giggles, probably Stormbreaker.
Stormbreaker.
We haven't released that to the public.
Stormbreaker was a fun one to do. Hulk made us giggle like drains.
That's true, but that is in the podcast.
That is in the podcast. Yeah. Interesting, we were having this chat off air. Sometimes the podcasts that are better are the ones where we haven't necessarily enjoyed the movie.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we weren't particularly complimentary about either Stormbreaker or Hulk. But there you go. No, there's have been so many... Now, I mean, I think we're up to about 40-something episodes now. So it's hard to say which has been the favourite, but they're the ones that stick out. I did enjoy, also I enjoyed the Curse of the Were-Rabbit, both movie and recording.
I was going to say that one, actually, yeah. Do you know in certain cinemas in the UK they're re-releasing Curse of the Were-Rabbit for its 20th anniversary this year?
Really?
Oh, we don't. I don't know whether to go or not.
Oh, you definitely should.
I might try, depending if it's close to me or not.
It depends on how much you could live with the regret of not going.
Yeah.
Because it's a couple of hours, a couple of quid. You may never get a chance to see that movie at the cinema again, except for its 30th anniversary.
Well, yeah, true. That's a good point, actually. I'll consider it, yeah.
Yeah, I think I would definitely go and see it if I was anywhere near a cinema that was showing it. You never know. There we are.
Yeah.
I wonder if we'll have as much fun talking about The Amazing Spider-Man 2, the 2014 classic Sony/Marvel movie.
Yeah, I'm not sure. We'll have to see, I think, yeah.
I gave it a fairly median memory score of 5 from memory. Do you remember yours?
9 out of 10, yeah.
Yeah, so I gave it 5, you gave it 9. Interesting. Do you think
it is interesting?
Do you think the score will change?
I'm not actually sure at all.
Interesting. I think mine will change. I think mine will change. Let's see.
You can't go into minus numbers though.
No.
I think I kind of want to kick things off with, as soon as I started the film, knowing what I was going into, one of the things that always stands out to me and my not imaginary sister is that this has an absolutely fantastic soundtrack just from start to finish. It's a bit, at first it seems a bit out there, and not very Hans Zimmer, I'll say, but getting into it and years later, it's perfect.
Yeah, it is a really good soundtrack. I did actually think that. And you really can't go wrong with Hans Zimmer as the guy that's doing it, can you? It is a very good soundtrack. It's kind of inspirational, almost.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, the sort of theme that brings Spider-Man onto the screen at the beginning of the film is My Alarm, and has been for the past, must have been 10 years. So every morning I wake up to that sound anyway.
Wow. It is... Am I right in thinking?
All right, don't sound too interesting.
I'm sorry, did I not sound interested in that?
just a little bit.
I just go, whatever. Yeah, brilliant. I didn't mean to. I was planning my next thought. Do you want to say it again and I'll sound more interested the next time around? Go on, do it again.
You could just come in with your, I don't know what I said.
Neither do I.
It's my alarm and has been for 10 years.
That's pretty cool that that's your alarm and it has been for 10 years. That's very cool. And you've never changed it.
I mean, well, okay. I think on the odd occasion I've changed it. When I had to get up every Saturday to see a Spider-Man film in the cinema last year, I would change it to the film that was going to be watched, because I was going to use one anyway,
right?
I was going to use a Spider-Man song anyway to wake myself up, so I thought I'll keep it on theme. Some of them I'm glad that I woke up before the alarm, because I set really loud ones, so that could have been a problem.
I think that's very cool. I use the same piece of music to wake up to for ages, years ago. I don't do it anymore, mostly because I don't sleep, but I that piece of music, which I woke up to, if I now hear that piece of music, I can't enjoy it, because it's like,
I've had that conversation with someone.
It's like, I don't know, because you're making me do a thing I don't want to do. So I just wonder,
it sort of gives you that, whenever you hear it out of context, it gives you that little shiver of, oh, I need to wake up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That, yeah. Did you get that when you hear this soundtrack then?
Funny enough, no, not in this film.
Interesting.
But if I hear it just off the cuff, yeah.
Well, yeah, maybe separate from the movie, is just a piece of music. It works differently. I was very surprised to learn that the soundtrack by Hans Zimmer was actually co-written with Pharrell Williams.
Yeah.
Isn't he the guy that sings pop songs that aren't very good?
Yeah, he sings the song that was played on the Virgin Media hold note phone call thing, Happy.
That's the one. And they kind of formed this little supergroup. But it seems to have worked, this odd collaboration, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. I think that's what's quite surprising about it. And I think the sort of dubstep elements that you get are very influenced by that. Like, I don't think Hans Zimmer would have immediately chosen to do that.
It is a fascinating collaboration. I do like collaborations like that. There are a couple that spring to mind that aren't even remotely relevant. But probably about 12 years ago, Brian May, him from Queen, did a song with a young rap artist. I think it was called Dappy or something like that.
Right.
And it was like, it turned out to actually be quite a cool song. But I remember looking at it thinking, oh, why is that happening? But it actually worked really, really well. Sometimes those odd things can work.
I will say, though, about the soundtrack of this film, it is an absolute shame that we didn't get to hear James Horner's version of it, like, officially anyway. Because obviously he did the Amazing Spider-Man 1. And I've always wanted to know what that would have been like.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't remember why he dropped out of it. But interestingly enough, if you go online, there's a leaked trailer from Comic-Con of when this film was being announced, and you can hear James Horner's soundtrack played over footage from this film. And it's amazing, like, no pun intended, it's genuinely amazing. People have tried to recreate it, but it's never quite the same thing.
I think James Horner might be one of my favourites. I know we've done this competition before, but I definitely think he is.
Yeah, me too.
I'd like to hear that. The times in this movie when the soundtrack is at its best are when Spider-Man is flying through the air. Like
Absolutely.
The visuals and the music are the perfect marriage.
I've got loads of stupid, pointless trivia about this film. But here's another one. The theme song that I referenced before is My Alarm. That was released as a piece of music before the film came out. And everyone assumed that was going to be the Daily Bugle's theme song.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was going to be an online or TV sort of thing, and that was the intro. So it's kind of interesting to see that people have sort of put it together as what it is, but it isn't that.
I want to jump in here because you just made me think of a thing. So I'm going to segue into a different point. Which is, you mentioned the Daily Bugle. I did feel the lack of Daily Bugle in this movie.
Yeah, I think looking back in hindsight as well, having J. Jonah Jameson as a guy on an email just doesn't really work. You need him actually there for it to have an impact.
You do. You need him to be there. You need the J. Jonah Jameson. And because even if it's a different actor, you need that person in there as a sort of foil to it.
Rumours it was going to be Ice Cube playing J. Jonah, which I don't think that would have worked very well, but no, I would have been interested to see it.
Yeah, it would have been interesting to see. And it's, I appreciate the expansion of the Spider-Verse, I think we call it now. I quite like the fact that, you know, in the much longer history of Spider-Man now, this particular universe can stand on its own. Because, and I think that's really clever, because it then stops you from making the comparisons between Tobey Maguire, Andrew Garfield, Tom Holland,
yeah,
and actually they can all coexist with each other, because Andrew Garfield's Spider-Man I'm going to go out on a limb here, he is the best actor to play Spider-Man.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. There's loads of people saying Toby's better at Peter Parker or Andrew's better at Spider-Man. I think Andrew does quite well as both. I think sometimes he acts a bit cool. I may have mentioned this in the other episode, but I think even Stan Lee has said that that's not a problem. But I think he does a great job of doing Peter Parker and Spider-Man. And I don't know, I must have mentioned this in the other one, but he's very good at being the shy Peter Parker, but then the confident guy in a mask that no one can see.
Absolutely.
And I've always really appreciated that about the character.
And I mean, again, to go out on one of my slightly potentially snappy limbs, I think it's not just that he is a good Spider-Man or the best Spider-Man or whatever. In my view, he is the best actor. He's a better actor than Tobey Maguire, and he's a better actor than Tom Holland, both of whom are amazing, if you'll pardon the pun. I just think he's a proper serious actor that is bringing something to the role different. And as you rightly say, it's that balance between geek and not geek, really.
Yeah, I think, as you say, bringing the balance to it, I think that's really what nails it for me anyway, yeah.
Did you know that 65% of Spider-Mans are English?
I did know that, yeah.
Statistically speaking.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's
fun.
It is an interesting thing that the All-American hero is played by two English people, or at least in different iterations.
Especially considering as well that in recent years, Superman was also played by a British actor.
Do you think that's a deliberate thing? We are a long way off topic from this movie now, but do you think that's deliberate? Or do you think it's just, this is the actor that we want, he's a fine actor?
I think so, yeah. I think that's the case. I mean, I'd hope that they wouldn't purposely Well, okay, what I'll say is I'm kind of glad in a way that they branch out to say actors who aren't American for those kinds of things. That makes sense. But I don't know if they'd go specifically out of their way.
But I agree that it is interesting that there is... I think that if you're in Hollywood and you're casting and you've got somebody who can do an American accent and they're British, I think there's a general feeling that that works best. Maybe I'm thinking of baddies from 1980s movies, but this always seems to be like, you know, the casting of a British person. And we did talk, I suppose, about the cast, the first film, but I quite like Aunt May. Yeah. I quite like Aunt May in this as well, Sally Field. It's good that she's allowed to be a slightly different Aunt May too.
Yeah, I've always sort of, I think deep down she's my favourite iteration of that character. I mean, I don't mind the new one who's died in the movie, but I do think Sally Field plays this in a very sort of clever... She definitely knows that he's Spider-Man,
yeah,
but she's not going to reveal it because she loves him, and you can see that there's a genuine connection between both the actors and the characters, and I think that really works quite well.
Well, she again, you know, to repeat myself, she's just the best actress to play Aunt May.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the best looking. That would be the...
I might cut that. That would be...
That would be the first one.
Okay. All right, okay. I kind of want to talk to you about the structure of this film and the story and the plot and all of that kind of thing. So as you would in my position, what did you think of it?
Well, it's a good question.
Thanks.
I think the film is strangely joyless. And I don't think that's okay. Really an answer to your question. Somebody always has to die in a Spider-Man movie, and I've never quite figured out why that is. It just seems to be a theme, you know. In the recent ones, Aunt May gets killed off. Gwen Stacy in this one, Uncle Ben has to die in every version. His parents have to die. It isn't in my view a very good plot and or story.
Yeah.
I think there's an awful lot of threads that get kind of left hanging that aren't then picked up, and that's probably because there were cancelled sequels and things. But it's fine. Mm-hmm. It's serviceable enough. I wasn't overly fond of the kind of baddie in this. It wasn't very interesting. Their character arc wasn't that interesting. I hope I'm not saying things that you utterly disagree with. But it was fine.
No, it was
perfectly serviceable. I wouldn't have any massive problems with it. But it sounds like you have something to say about it.
Maybe, yeah. I think for me, the issue that I take with this film, and it's definitely been since I've seen it the first time around and become more aware, is it's... The best way to describe this, and I thought about this, is in Amazing Spider-Man and the podcast that we did, I mentioned that the first film is structured like a mini-series. So you could cut different parts up and like a Disney Plus series. Episode 1 comes out this week and then so on. And it works as a story. This film is organized more like you just want to watch random YouTube clips of the same film, but not necessarily in the right order.
Yeah, that's a very good way of looking at it.
Yeah, so it feels like in my head... And I think this is partially true. There was an overarching storyline. There was a film in place. And I think it focused more on the characters of Peter and Gwen. But then I think Sony came in and just said, actually, no, we want more villains, and chop the story up this way. So it kind of just falls into these horrible, unorganized or disorganized pieces of film that don't really have a story. And I think I'd love to make an edit of this film, but I probably couldn't. I couldn't do any better. Maybe. But I think for me, I would take out the whole Harry Osborn Green Goblin storyline. I'd keep him in, but maybe not have that in this film. But then you can't kill Gwen. So you're at a bit of a standstill with it.
And I think as well, because of the and I'm sure we'll talk about this, and if we're not, this is a good time to do it anyway. Because of the cancelled sequels, I think they're kind of setting up the Green Goblin to be the baddie in the next movie. And so, you know, and then he has to be the sworn enemy because he is the person responsible for killing Gwen Stacy. I mean, the climax of the movie is crushingly disappointing.
It is, yeah.
So you get Electro. He seems pretty easy to have gotten rid of.
Yeah.
Then Gwen dies and the Green Goblin runs away. And then you get Rhino Guy for no reason whatsoever. who then would appear to get beaten about the head with a manhole cover. And that, and that's the end. And I got to the end, and I haven't seen this film anywhere near as much as you have. And I got to the end and I thought, okay, oh no, that's the end.
Yeah, I know a lot of people kicked off apparently because they wanted to see what actually happened next, but we didn't get to see it. It was like, what's the point of teasing a third villain in the film in the trailers and at the end of the movie just to cut it there? And then at the time we didn't know we'd never see it, but we never saw it.
No, but that happens sometimes, doesn't it, when you get the whole cancelled sequel thing. We talked about that on Stormbreaker, Golden Compass. There's been loads where you just think, you know, what even if the film was terrible, you would still like to have seen where they were going with it. It reminds me of Aragorn, which we didn't like particularly. But I would happily go and watch a sequel because I'd be interested enough to find out what had happened. And this just left me like, oh, that's the end. And what a massive anticlimax it was.
Yeah. See, my perception of this film is kind of warped because someone wrote a script for what they thought Amazing Spider-Man 3 could be. And I've read that script because I'm a sado. So there's certain things in this film that I've sat there thinking, oh, this leads into this, but it doesn't. But because I've sort of read that and apparently it's true now, I sort of know that there's a sequel, but there isn't.
You know, when we get around to doing one of our special episodes, and we should do one of those quite soon, you should do the, if I was making Amazing Spider-Man 3, this is what it would look like. And then I'll do, if I was allowed to make Flash Gordon as a reboot, this is what it would look like. And we should definitely do those. Yeah. Let's agree that you'll definitely do Amazing Spider-Man 3 and I'll do Flash Gordon as a couple of specials in the future.
Okay. Yeah, I like that.
That's cool. We have mentioned Andrew Garfield and we have mentioned Sally Field, amongst others. But it is a strong cast of actors overall.
Yeah.
Okay. Emma Stone is good. Jamie Foxx is good. They're all good actors in service of an okay script. I wasn't that keen on this particular iteration of the Green Goblin, but I think that's because Willem Dafoe is the Green Goblin.
Well, yeah, exactly that. Yeah.
It's interesting that you can change Spider-Man as often as you like, apparently, but not the Green Goblin.
So much so that they bring Willem Dafoe back to play the Green Goblin.
Correct. And this poor fella didn't get a look in, although he was suitably intense, I thought.
Yeah, I think he pulls off the intensity quite well. But part of that, I think, comes from the makeup. I think once you're in that makeup, you can visualise yourself as that character and go for it.
The CGI Spider-Man bits are quite good, aren't they?
Yeah, I think that's one of the best. Again, I've watched too much of the behind the scenes of it, and it's going to sound incredibly nerdy, but I know the CGI, that they paid close attention to the actual fabric, so you can see these wrinkles that wouldn't necessarily, that would be more realistic on an actual person rather than just a completely skin tight costume. I'm going to stop talking because that's incredibly nerdy.
Well, the thing that I noticed and this is a development, I think, is in the first couple of Spider-Man movies with Tobey Maguire, the CGI is great, except for when they're trying to replicate human movement and it looks a bit cartoonish. Whereas this, I thought, it utterly kind of nailed it. You know, it looked very, very convincing, like there was an actual person inside of it. And maybe that is the fabric. Maybe it really is as simple as that.
I will say, though, that I think this is the best live-action Spider-Man suit.
Oh, yeah, by miles. Yeah. Where do they get them all from?
There's a tie-in comic where it's explained that Gwen makes this costume.
She's very clever, that Gwen,
again,
isn't she?
Again, nerdy.
No, she's very clever.
But then again, it's still not convincing enough to be real.
No, but like Electro, he is just Electro, and then the next time you see him, he's wearing a cool costume.
I actually noticed something this time around, or maybe I just knew it the whole time but only addressed it. Just in the scene before Harry breaks Electro free, he walks past Dr. Kafka talking to what looks like a security guard. The security guard is wearing the Electro costume. So I don't know if he stole it from him or if they just had a few lying around because it's an electric conducting thingy. But I did notice that this time, yeah.
I didn't notice that. That's a good detail. He probably stole his costume because otherwise he'd be walking around naked the whole time, right?
That is true. But then again, that's a comic thing.
But again, you can't ask that question. It is the King Kong on top of the Empire State Building question. But every time I watch Spider-Man, I think, where did the costume come from? In the kind of Peter Parker, not Peter, in the Tobey Maguire one, you can kind of see that he makes it somehow. But there you go. No, it is the best costume. And I also think it's the best flying through New York as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I think at the time it was fresh for that sort of thing, but putting the sort of GoPro type camera on him so you can see from his perspective is quite clever as well.
And also that's very good because it's a really cool effect, and I suspect it's much easier than constantly animating somebody.
Yeah, true.
Why did Gwen Stacy have to die?
You'd have to ask the comic book writers that one.
Okay, because does she die in the comic book as well?
She does. Actually, I remember when we saw this film together, we came out of the cinema and you said, I didn't actually expect them to kill her off. And I was like, oh, I just thought that was common knowledge from the comics. But yeah, it's true. Got a bit trivia about it, actually.
Have you got some trivia?
About that one thing, yeah.
Let's hear that piece of trivia before I ask my pointless question.
When Gwen does actually die, the time on the broken clock lands on the same number as the issue of comic that she dies.
That's magnificent. Magnificent
trivia. It is, yeah. But it's one of those things that I don't think you'd notice unless someone pointed out. Not for me, anyway, because I can't read analog clocks, obviously.
Can you not read analog clocks?
No, I can. I just choose not to.
Okay. Yeah. I agree. They're very ignorant, aren't they? Just show us the numbers. You know, your fancy,
exactly.
Your fancy hands and numbers and shapes and whatever. Just tell us.
I'm saving time by looking at a digital clock.
Correct. That is true. You're saving.
See what I did there?
I can. I can see what you've done there. I didn't think it was necessary for her to die in the plot of the movie. I get that it was necessary for her to die in the wider legend of Spider-Man. But as a movie plot, it felt, I don't want to say gratuitous because that's the wrong word, but it felt like the movie wouldn't have been that different if she hadn't died. And again, I think it's a, we need to find out what impact this has on Spider-Man in the third film that didn't happen. But I didn't think she needed to die.
I personally think that the story might have benefited more if she died in the third film, and it would have been the audience gets more attached to this relationship, and then you kill her off. I think the original idea, and they did shoot some of this, was to have Mary Jane come along in the story, so there's that other third person to get involved. And I think if they followed that and maybe killed Gwen off in the third film, you could have built that whole comic book type relationship and then worked it from there. Maybe that's why I would have changed this film. I would have included Mary Jane, and I would have kept Harry as Harry, not the Green Goblin, and then you could have had those four friends, and then things escalate later on.
Yeah, it did feel like, again, you know, it's the Spiderwick maneuver. I may go to Oxford. I've been accepted into Oxford. I love you. Okay, let's go on an adventure together. Are you dead?
Yeah,
I like that.
I mean, the good news is that other kid got into Oxford.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, okay. Yeah, he's every cloud. But I do have difficulty in Spider-Man movies with the amount of death that there is.
Yeah, I think the running theme is Spider-Man wins, but Peter Parker loses.
You've nailed it. I cannot improve upon that. That's the theme. That's exactly it.
Even in like the latest one, with Tom Holland, like Spider-Man wins, he saves the day, but at the cost of Peter Parker no longer existing.
Yeah, that is true.
And we'll explore that in Spider-Man now.
There is another. They have announced a new Spidey, haven't they, with Tom Holland?
Yeah, brand new day. Shivers in Spider-Man comic.
But it is enormously bankable. I mean, this is an okay film, and I mean that in the nicest possible way. It's not amazing, even though it's called that. It's a very, very good Sony/Marvel Spider-Man movie. Cost probably $250 million to make. makes $716 million at the box office. It is bankable. People will go and see these movies.
Yeah.
And I think as a franchise, let's not do it, but if you check, and of course it wins because there's been quite a lot of them, but it must be into the 3, 4, 5 billion just for Spider-Man alone.
Probably, yeah.
And that's just a ridiculous amount of money. The other thing
if you consider it to be Spider-Man.
The other thing I want to say about this movie doesn't suffer from superhero fatigue at this point.
No. I did have an interesting point about that, and I came across something on the World Wide Web, which said that 2010 films, or films around that era, had this obsession with Nolanizing everything, in the terms of, like, Christopher Nolan's Batman films, making everything a bit dark and more gritty. And one of the examples that they used was the first Amazing Spider-Man film. And I think this film, Amazing Spider-Man 2, kind of dodges the whole Nolanizing, if you like, and it becomes a bit more of a brighter, friendly superhero film. So I do think it sort of, it doesn't necessarily stick out as much as you'd want it to, but there's definitely a tonal shift from Amazing Spider-Man 1 to Amazing Spider-Man 2 that is totally welcome. And I think that in some respects is why it works.
Yeah, that's probably fair enough. It's very colourful. It has a certain darkness about it.
Yeah.
Which is a bit Nolan-esque, but it also has that, it has enough light and shade to not lose itself in the darkness of it all.
I like that, yeah.
I can't improve upon that. It did feel overstuffed with plot at times. It just felt like there was too much going on.
It has that sort of same problem as Spider-Man 3, where it just keeps introducing villains, and I think it just needs one. Maybe a second one at the end to tease the sequel, but you don't need that many villains in one go.
If you consider I don't want to give away the ending of our podcast, but if you consider at this point there have been 5 Spider-Man movies as of 2014, not counting the ones afterwards, does this rank as bad as Spider-Man 3? I don't think it does it?
I think it's sort of up for debate. I think it's probably on even terms, but for different reasons, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have any out-of-pocket takes and more trivia for us on this movie? Surely you do.
I think it's a mixture of both, but I could probably come up with some on the spot.
Do it.
But also probably not. The kid that Spider-Man interacts with, he's got the wind turbine, and he's the little nerdy one that shows up at the end to save the day.
Uh-huh.
Did you know his name changes?
I did not.
So the actor, I don't know his surname, but the actor's called Jorge in real life. Uh-huh. Apparently on set, he couldn't understand the concept of having a different name, or maybe he forgot. So when he's talking to Spider-Man, he introduces himself as Jorge. But then later on in the movie, when he jumps out in front of Rhino, his mum screams Joe. So his name completely changes. Wow. I don't know why they didn't just ADR it or just accept or just change it to one or the other. Yeah.
I'm embarrassed to admit that I didn't know it was the same person.
Oh,
okay. I did not make that connection. I thought it was really interesting that this kid had sort of come out, and I did not get that it was the same person. That's because they changed the name.
Yeah.
If they shouted Jorge.
Yeah, exactly.
That it probably would have worked for me. I'm missing this movie. Some of the interactions. I like the school stuff. When Peter Parker's the geek at school, and he's kind of, and he does that so well in this in the first version, in this sort of iteration. And Peter, I always call him Peter Parker, and Tobey Maguire does it quite well. I missed a little bit of all of that. It's kind of more grown up Spider-Man. Just it's not quite the same, is it?
Yeah, I think that's what this one suffers from a lot as well, is it should have stayed a bit more in school. Like, I know the latest trilogy does that, and that works quite well. But I think there's just this weird obsession with going, oh, Spider-Man's a teenager, now he has to find a job because he's out of school. It's like, does it really need to be that way? Like, Spider-Man's one of those audiences where you can... It's children that you're sort of appealing to, and young adults, and they're in school, so that works.
Yeah,
why do they keep on kicking him out of school?
It seems so incredibly rootless as well. He's obviously very clever, and he's obviously a superhero and Spider-Man. Mary Jane is not Mary Jane. Gwen Stacy's off to Oxford University. He just is basically wandering around.
taking pictures of himself.
Taking pictures of himself to sell to Ice Cube. Who we never meet, he's just an email.
Another thing that they changed from the first film, as in Amazing Spider-Man, is that in the sequel, this one, there every fight scene that he's in, he wears a mask. And that was apparently a complaint, even about the Toby ones as well, that Spider-Man always loses his mask in a fight scene. So And it's probably just show off the actor, because that's where the money comes in. But yeah, in this movie, they purposely keep the mask on. And I like that choice. It's a good one, yeah.
That is a good choice, because, yeah, Spider-Man's secret identity is not that secret to the people that he's trying to keep it a secret from. It is the worst-kept secret, isn't it? I mean, within his circle of friends, at least, I suppose.
Yeah, it does kind of open a bit of a plot hole with No Way Home, though.
Which is?
Everyone who gets sent to that universe knows who Peter Parker is, but Electro doesn't. Yeah. So they've had to sort of bridge that gap and say, oh, he downloaded all of this data before he died, which is a bit unrealistic, because where did he get the data from?
Yeah, I'd actually had forgotten as well, because I don't have the same attention to detail as you do. I'd actually forgotten that Electro was in the No Way Home thing.
Yeah, he's a very background character.
Is he the worst Spider-Man villain? I don't think he is he?
Maybe not. I think sometimes with Spider-Man you've got the D-list villains, and I think he's probably almost one of them. So some of them don't work, and unless you know how to do it like Sandman, that works.
Yeah. But he's no Green Goblin, is he?
No, not at all. And Doc Ock.
And again, it is the suspension of disbelief of any superhero movie and plot or whatever. But he fell into a tank of electric eels,
which fixed his teeth, yeah.
And grew his hair back and slightly changed his voice and his personality. It's a shoehorned character arc. That's what it is. It's just struck me. He has to go from blueprint carrying geek to supervillain, and they shoehorn, I love Spider-Man, he's my best friend, he's my guy. Oh, he's rejected me, I'm now a bad person. And they spiderwick the hell out of his story arc, and it stops being believable for me, I think.
Yeah, I think I agree with that.
Any controversial opinions on this movie?
I don't know if this is hugely controversial, but it's an opinion that I have. Is the line, every time I get close to him, he fries my web shooters, is the worst line in any Spider-Man film ever. And I get that it's on point and it makes sense for the film. There's just something I don't like about it. It's one of those gimmicky, put it in kind of lines that just doesn't fit for me.
But again, it's an overstuffed plot, because then we have to see Gwen Stacy say, well, that's why you are number two. Here is the solution. Let's jumpstart them from a car.
And I don't know if this bothers me more, but the solution... So that's the solution to the web shooters. The solution to stop an Electro is what he tried to do to fix the web shooters, make the battery explode.
Yes.
And I don't know if that's a good connection, or if it's just a bit too much, like scientific detail, but then it's a bit of a callback. I don't know how I feel about it, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't know either. All I'll say on that theme is that he was just too easy to kill.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
He's gone. There we go. That's the end of that. Let's get him out of the way. We've got the Green Goblin now.
Yeah. Also, kill is interesting, because Spider-Man doesn't kill, but Electro clearly gets killed.
Yeah. That's true.
Like, the first three films, they all die either to sacrifice themselves or due to their own failure.
Yeah.
Or something along those lines. In Amazing Spider-Man 1, Lizard goes to jail. In Amazing Spider-Man 2, he straight up murders Electro.
So true. Oh, I never thought of that.
How does that work?
I don't know. Oh, yeah.
Does it count because he's just electricity? Like, does he actually kill someone in this film?
Is he already dead, and therefore it's just kind of an act of mercy on his part?
Yeah. But then in No Way Home, it's, I died. Yeah. And it's like,
yeah,
so you were killed.
You were killed. And the other thing is, I mean, frustrating from a plot point of view was all the power's gone out. All the airplanes are flying around in the in complete darkness. There's got to be a failsafe for that, right?
Yeah. The other thing that annoys me about the airplanes, though, is suddenly the radios come back on. And he's like, oh, you need to lower the plane. You need to go down. And both pilots don't do that. They just go past each other in a different way. Nobody actually listens. They didn't need that to come back online. Also, one of those pilots is in Chuck.
I didn't see that either.
Yeah.
It is overstuffing. None of that stuff is necessary. There's no danger. The only way that pays off is if an aeroplane crashes, and you can't do that. You can't do that. You can't waste all that life. But the only way that you can do anything with the tension that you're attempting to build is for that airplane to crash, or at least, you know, have to be stopped from being crashed by Spider-Man doing an heroic thing.
Yeah.
It's just quick, go down. I'll tell you what, instead of going down, let's just separate from each other. Problem solved. And then we move on. And that was, it just felt, again, you know, it's very exciting, whatever, but actually not terribly exciting because there's no payoff. And the script is interesting because the script is written by, the kind of same team that writes the more recent Star Trek movies, and they seem to just be kind of writers for hire for a particular kind of movie. So they can plot out a movie. They can get what I guess you'd call a movie beat, and it's you know your first act, your second act, your third act, and they can clearly write, but it does seem a bit formulaic at times.
It does, yeah, and I think in this instance the formula was mixed around and just put in a random order.
And then you get in, see, the first three Spider-Man movies, or at least the first couple, which is Sam Raimi directed, you felt there's kind of a connection with the source material. This did feel a little bit more Spider-Man by numbers. It was nicely directed, I have to say, and you know, the character stuff and the quality of the acting and perfectly nicely directed. But I couldn't say that I felt the same connection with the universe in this middle block of Spider-Man than I would get on the ones on either side.
Yeah, I will say, though, that I do think Mark Webb is a good character director, and you could see his vision for this film before it was sort of taken away from him. And I would have liked to have seen that film. As much as it probably would have lacked the action, I think it was good in terms of character, yeah.
It might, however, have strayed into Hulk territory, where you spend so much time being characterful and driven, and let's do this seriously. I don't think you really want that in your superhero movies, do you?
No, I suppose there is quite a lot of that towards the sort of end of this film. Again, that's another thing, is you're sort of watching it, and all of a sudden, all the action's starting, and it's like it's rolling down a hill all of a sudden. Uh-huh. And here we go, the movie's going again. And now we're in the big fight scene, that's the end. And I do think it sort of suffers from that a bit.
But if you're working with Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone, who are both tremendously good actors, I think if you are the director, you're probably thinking and even saying to the actors, come on, let's pull something out of these people. Let's stop them from being two-dimensional Marvel characters. Let's make them into something else. And I think that's really valid, and I think it's a really fair interpretation. I do prefer my Spider-Man to be a bit two-dimensional.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah,
I get that that's controversial. If you disagree with me, that's fine. I you know, here's an example of what I mean. So in the first Thor movie with Kenneth Branagh, it's all heavily Shakespearean, very serious, they're all gods. And then you go to the other extreme with Taika Waititi a bit further down. But there's a middle Thor that's much, much more fun. It stops being desperately serious. It must be, and then it stops being really silly. And there's a really kind of good, they've done enough with the character for it to be interesting without it being far too serious or far too silly.
Mm-hmm.
It's a terrible example. But I hope people...
No, I thought it was a good example.
I hope people know what I mean. I think I'm ready to go to my score for this movie, because otherwise we'll spend hours talking about it.
And I think we'll end up going down the negative path too much, yeah.
Yeah. So I gave it 5. Nice middling score. I'm very conflicted, you know, because
Okay.
I'm conflicted because I think it's better than a 5. It's not my favourite Spider-Man movie. And I am therefore going to go to 7 out of 10. So I'm going to go up by 2.
Okay.
And I think that puts it quite nicely in our list of benefit of hindsight movies where it's decent without being amazing, if you'll pardon the pun. So I'm going to go up 2 to 7. And part of that 7 is because Andrew Garfield is a fabulous actor and I could watch him in anything.
Yeah. I'm honestly a bit torn. It's quite difficult for me to score this one. Obviously, I gave 9 out of 10 as my memory score because it was a 9 out of 10 when I first watched it. But amongst millions of rewatches, because I can literally quote this entire film, it's not as good as I remember it being at all. It's all over the place and it's very messy. But I do like it because it's a Spider-Man film, and I have this weird sort of thing where they haven't yet made a Spider-Man film that I don't like. I made this note very early on. I don't care what anyone says or whatever happens, but this is my Spider-Man. So I'm going to go down by 1, and I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10.
Okay.
Not because I don't think it's as good as my memory, but also because I do just like it and I enjoy it and I've got great memories of it and I can sit down and watch it any time that I want to.
That's
8
good.
Out of 10.
I think that's a good answer and a good reason. One word review of the movie?
Thanks. Oh, I've been thinking about this the whole time and I was going to steal a word from you, but now I can't remember what it was. I don't know, because I don't want to go really harsh. But yeah. I want to use a good word. So I'm going to go with decent.
Decent is good. I'm going to go with... my one word review is premature.
Yeah, okay.
Because it ends badly. It's not a great ending. And the whole franchise at this point shouldn't have ended. There should have been a third movie.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go premature, even though that's a terrible word to describe it. There you have it. Well, we will choose a new movie, but we're going to have to take a bit of a break because I'm quite busy next week. So we should choose a movie that takes 2 weeks to watch. So if you're a regular listener, we won't be here next week, but we will the following week, fingers crossed, all being well. So you're going to choose the movie, Sam. So I think you can afford to go with something that's at least a two-weeker.
Yeah. There's an obvious choice, but it's not... But the one that I've chosen is not the one that you think it's going to be.
Okay.
But I actually do think that this is one of those... It's a long one, I would say. Okay. And I think you do need to... You could probably space it apart. Interestingly, the reason I chose this film is because I was listening to music from films yesterday.
Okay.
And I heard this piece of music and thought, such a good piece of music. I want to rewatch the film. We have already done the first one.
Uh-huh.
But again... Not the movie you're thinking of. It's the 2006 classic Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest.
Oh, excellent. Okay. I was expecting you to pull out some Tolkien there, I think, but I'm down with that. Pirates of the Caribbean. Well, you have to go first because you chose a film, so your memory score of this.
Yeah, this was one of those films that we were excited for because we'd seen the first one and we'd prepared for. So I think I was always excited to go and see it. And I do think out of the, I was going to say 3, but we did see a 4th one and there is a 5th one. Out of the Pirates of the Caribbean films that we saw together, this one's probably tied as my favourite, but I do think this is a great film. So I'm going to go with, similar to Spider-Man, 9 out of 10.
Okay. My memory of this one is very similar to everything that you've just said. The first Pirates of the Caribbean movie had been a very pleasant surprise and people loved it. And this is one of those ones where they say, oh, we're going to go big, we're going to do massive and it's going to be whatever. And it was great. They pulled it off and I really liked it. I don't think I remember it being a 9. I'm going to go with an 8. So it's solid.
Okay.
Good score. But I'm conflicted because I gave it an 8. Which means I've already scored it 1 point higher than The Amazing Spider-Man 2. And I don't think it is. I don't think it's better than it. But I'll stick with my original score of 8 because that's how the podcast works.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for listening to our podcast. You can, of course, contact us through our email, which is thebenefitofhindsightpodcast@gmail.com. We do like to hear from you. Please do share the podcast with anybody that you think might also enjoy it. And thank you very much for listening. Do you have a day of the week for us, Sam?
I didn't, but then my computer said something, and I think you'll love it. It's International Unicorn Day.
I love it. I love it. Yeah, cool. Do you know that the unicorn is a real animal?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and the reason why I know that that's true is because it's the national animal of Scotland.
Oh, I didn't know that.
In the same way that the dragon is the national animal of the Welsh.
Oh, yeah.
So if you are brave enough to have those animals as your national animal, they must therefore be real animals.
As real as the Loch Ness Monster, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've never actually seen a unicorn in the wild, but that doesn't mean I haven't seen a bear in the wild.
Well, exactly, yeah. So that's a good point.
So bears, to me, are as mythical as unicorns. And I saw a unicorn in a movie last week.
Did? Oh, yeah, we did.
Yeah.
That's true.
So to all the unicorns out there, enjoy your day.
Yeah. I don't know how you're listening to a podcast, but there you go.
Well, headphones.
Ah, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably like horse-shaped and horse-sized, but some of them. Yeah. Maybe
I think they make those.
Maybe some of them have like an Alexa or something.
Yeah, yeah. Although I think Steve Jobs patented some Apple headphones for horses and unicorns. Yeah,
he did. Yeah. Do you think do you think if you were a unicorn, would you change TV just by moving your head forward?
Oh, there's no other way.
You wouldn't need a remote control, would you?
It's the only way.
Two unicorns watching TV. One says, change channel, Steve. It leans his head forward, press the button, click. Job done.
Nice, yeah.
Well, to all the unicorns out there, enjoy your day. It's much deserved. Thank you very much for listening to our podcast. We'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with our views on Pirates of the Caribbean Part 2. But all is left for us to do now is to say goodbye.
Goodbye.
With the benefit of hindsight, we'll see, were the movies truly awful, or did they change history?